February 21st, 2017, House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness is now open. We're going to do a couple of things out of order today to honor the time of Representative Gomberg and his guest. We're going to move House Bill 2574 up. Then we're going to close that public hearing. We're going to have the Emergency Preparedness invited testimony, and then after that, we'll have a public hearing and possible work session, but mostly public hearing on House Bills 2886 and 2888. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2574. Mr. Volk, would you please give us a summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The original House Bill 2574 directs the Office of Emergency Management to identify strategies to improve emergency preparedness education for Oregon residents and to report to the legislature by July 31st, 2019. It sunsets on January 2nd, 2020. There has been an amendment offered by Representative Gomberg, and this is effective what we call kind of a gut and stuff. So the effect of the amendment is that it would delete lines 4 through 10 of the House Bill 2574 and amends Oregon Revised Statute 336.071, which is a statute concerning emergency drills and instruction. Schools would be required to instruct on age-appropriate information for at least 4 hours per school year on survival in the days and weeks after a natural disaster. The Department of Education will be required to develop the age-appropriate curriculum relating to earthquake and tsunami safety for students kindergarten through grade 12. Each school district will be required to implement the curriculum unless the school district opts out by sending notice to the state resilience officer. The amount to be appropriated to the Department of Education for implementation has not been yet determined. The stated amendments would first apply to the 2019-2020 school year.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For your record, I'm David Gomberg from House District 10, and I am here today to talk about House Bill 2574. The original bill was a placeholder. The bill that we really want to talk to today is the Dash 1 amendments. And colleagues, you know that I represent the Central Oregon coast. And out on the coast, there is a growing awareness that at some point, perhaps in our lifetime or in our children's lifetime or certainly in our grandchildren's lifetime, that we will experience a major natural disaster. And as we begin to understand that, we begin to prepare for it. And now people are beginning to identify their evacuation routes. They're beginning to look at the supplies that they will need in order to recover from an event like this. And we're beginning to talk about how we restructure and re-engineer public buildings and personal property in order to be more resilient. We're beginning to get involved in this, but we have a long way to go. And that's what this bill is about, colleagues. It's about how we prepare for and how we recover from major natural disasters. And I say to you that my own district has got a long way to go, but if I could say respectfully, I think out on the coast, we're ahead of most parts of the state. Mr. Chairman, in your own district, if you could imagine a major natural disaster that brings down the bridges when many of your constituents are here on the east side of the river, but their families are on the west side of the river, and what happens then? Or Representative Post, I met with the director of DAS earlier this week, and I said, what happens here on the Capitol Mall in the case of a natural disaster? And the answer is the buildings will fall down. And the buildings will fall down, and the roads will ripple. And how do your constituents, many of whom who work here in the city core, make their way back to your district? Or Representative Meek, what's going to happen in downtown Portland when the bridges fall and the populations are divided and the power goes off and the water stops running? Representative Escoval, perhaps you don't have to worry as much about tsunamis as I do, but you certainly have to worry about fires.
Viaduct.
Indeed. And we need to worry, as we've recently seen, about the accumulation of snow. So I looked at this question of natural disasters and what we can do about it here in Oregon, and it occurs to me, colleagues, that very often education is generational. And by that I mean that very often parents learn from their children. And I wanted to take a look at what we can do now in our public schools and what we might do going forward to address the needs of Oregon and to create a culture of awareness in Oregon so that we're all better prepared. And so I came to you with a bill that does essentially three things. And the first thing has to do with scheduling. The current statutes say that we're going to spend time on a regular basis doing emergency drills, fire drills, active shooter drills, and earthquake drills. And I'm leaving that part untouched. The second part of the statute says that we will currently use half an hour each month to think about emergencies, emergency preparation. Now, my sense is that half an hour a month may be effective in some grades, but it may not be an effective use of time for all grades. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to change the statute to read at least 4 hours per year rather than half an hour each month. Now, I think that's significant because it's important that we all know we don't have enough time right now in the classroom for all the tasks that we want to accomplish in our schools. So I am not taking time away from other critical needs within our school system. If anything, I'm potentially reducing the amount of time that we allocate to emergencies, but I'm reorganizing the way that time is made available. So instead of half an hour a month, we're using at least 4 hours per year. Well, the next question then is, what are we going to do with this time? Are we going to burden our teachers with figuring out some kind of curriculum, or are we going to come up with a broader, better organized approach to emergency preparation? And so what I'm suggesting in this bill is that we create a position in the Department of Education, a limited duration, position, a one-time position that would not continue on long-term, and that person would be responsible for developing curriculum. And what I'm looking for is age-appropriate curriculum so that our youngest students learn about duck and cover, but they also learn what to do if they get home and mom and dad couldn't get home. Perhaps slightly older children might learn what kind of supplies should I have on hand for the kind of emergencies that are most likely in my area. What would go into my go kit? What kind of equipment do I need? What kind of food supplies? How many go kits do I need? And I'm asking that slightly older children might learn about first aid and involving themselves in our community and being part of a longer-term solution in helping not only their families but also their neighbors recover from a major natural disaster. So the third thing I'm looking at is that perhaps this kind of training is not appropriate for every district in the state. And I will let that decision be made by individual districts, but if they so choose, I'm giving them the opportunity in this legislation to opt out of this emergency training program. I'll say to you in all candor, I don't think that's a good idea, but I'll leave that on all of them. And so we've got three things here. To reorganize the time that we've got, where we teach kids how to prepare for natural disasters, and to make that time focus not only on surviving disaster immediately after it occurs, but surviving it in the weeks and days after the disaster occurs. The second thing we're doing is that we're providing a position that's going to organize curriculum so that those teachers aren't out there on their own, that we have a broad-based, organized, recommended curriculum that's teaching age-appropriate information in our schools. And finally, we're giving districts the opportunity to opt out if they don't think that this is appropriate for all of them. Mr. Chairman, the Department of Education has not yet had a chance to come back with a formal financial recommendation on this, but the original estimates are that the curriculum position would probably cost about $200,000 in the coming biennium. So that's going forward. I would say to you that I think it's important when we talk about natural disasters that we don't simply talk about getting out from underneath your desk and recognizing that you live through it, but you've got to be able to live through the period of time that immediately follows. When the power is off, perhaps for months. When the water is off, perhaps for months. When food supplies are having difficulty being delivered. And how we work together as a community, starting in our schools, to go forward and not only survive a major natural disaster, but recover from a major natural disaster. And so that's what I'm presenting to you today, and I hope it's going to be a long time before it happens, and I hope that when that long time unfolds before us, that we'll have a number of generations of Oregonians that have been through a 12-year program that better prepares them and their families and their communities for what ultimately is likely to happen here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Any questions for the representative? Sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Gomberg.
So I appreciate the part of this that says districts are allowed to opt out. So don't get me wrong. I understand clearly what you're saying. I couldn't agree more. One of the things my school district has asked me to quit doing in the legislature is changing their curriculum and telling them how to do their business, because every time we do that, it creates another cost. So in this case, I'm assuming it would there would be some cost involved with training teachers or taking the curriculum and doing it. But so my concern, and yours isn't the only bill around trying to address those things. And so at the end of the day, and we've talked some on this committee about communities being ready and how we do that. So at the end of the day, is there another way in which to deliver this for children or communities that doesn't necessarily require that the school be the mechanism?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lively, again, I would go back to the fact that our current statutes require half an hour each month in our classrooms. If anything, I hope that we're reducing costs for schools by providing them with some tools to use that time more effectively, or potentially reducing the amount of time that they're committed to this, and they can use that time for other requirements. So I think ultimately that my approach would cost districts less money and less time.
Representative Esperal?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, would it be a little better, and maybe I missed it, but this is just a four-hour period, could we not allow the schools the latitude to take that an hour once every other month? Wouldn't that be more appropriate? I can't imagine pinning up 53rd first graders for 4 hours. I'd probably have a problem with that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, I'm glad you asked that question, because I want to make this absolutely clear. When I say a minimum of 4 hours per year, that does not mean in a four-hour increment. It could mean half an hour in 8 different months. It could be 1 hour in 4 different months. It could be 2 hours in 2 months. I want to see the curriculum developed in a way that is most appropriate and most effective to reach the age-level students that it's being presented to.
Thank you for the clarification, because I wanted to make sure we got that on the record.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. I think this is an important topic, and the way you approach it, giving flexibility for courses that are already supposed to be given, I think is an important piece. Do you want to stay there as the guest comes up? Or
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
We invite Ms. Susan Graves, please join us, and state your name and where you are from for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Evans and committee. My name is Susan Graves, and I'm the safety coordinator for Lincoln County School District on the coast, on the beautiful Oregon coast. And I would like to share with you one of the strategies that we use in Lincoln County to educate our high school students on disaster preparedness and response and recovery. So I have a PowerPoint presentation, and I'm not sure where your screen is. There it is, right there. Okay. I believe so. All right. So it's called Teen Cert, and it's a semester, or in some of our schools we have terms. But it's a semester-long class in which students are taught how to prepare for disasters. And CERT stands for Community Emergency Response Team. So some of you might be aware of those. We have them in a lot of our communities where adults are trained in this. It's a FEMA curriculum. So the purpose of training teens on Teen Cert is so that when professional responders are not readily available because of a large catastrophic disaster like Representative Gomberg is speaking of, they have skills to be able to manage that immediate aftermath and help take care of themselves, their classmates, and their school if they're there when an emergency occurs of that magnitude. So it really empowers teens with lifelong learning skills that they can use at school if a disaster happens, or even if they're at home when a disaster occurs. The goals are to help yourself, help your family, help your neighbors if you're at home, or to help your school if you're at school when it occurs. Students love this class. It's very engaging. They learn all kinds of safety. Safety is their number one priority. Everything they do, safety is drilled into them. It becomes a part of them. They learn the buddy system to work in pairs. They check their gear. They all have safety gear that is kept at the school, so it's there if they need it when an emergency, big disaster occurs. They learn how to look out for each other's safety and the whole concept of accountability. And then they learn about the hazards and threats that are applicable to our area here in Oregon. And so we have guest speakers come in and speak about, you know, our seismic risks, speak about the volcanoes in our areas and other risks that we have, wildland fires. They learn how to identify and reduce hazards in their homes, how to make a disaster kit, how to turn off gas meters and other things in a large catastrophic disaster that might be very, very necessary. This is their favorite unit. They learn about fire safety. And so we practice in the classroom with little buckets and fake fire, learning how to use a fire extinguisher. And then the fire department comes and they actually get to put out a real small fire. They love this. They're hooked by the time they take this class, this part of the class. But it's also, you know, they're learning, again, safety. It's getting just drilled into them in practical, hands-on ways, not just the knowledge. And they learn a lot on disaster medical operations. They learn how to identify and what, treat what's called the three killers. If someone's airway is blocked, and they need to learn how to open an airway. If someone has excessive bleeding, they learn how to control bleeding. Or if someone is going into shock, there's circulation issues, and they learn how to treat for that. And then they learn how to do what is called triage, which is the French word, which means to sort. And they sort people out according to their injury so that they know who to treat first, treat the most critical first. This is a unit where they really learn assessment and decision-making skills. Those are really drilled into them. Oh, you probably saw the little stuffed animals. So these little stuffed animals have little scenarios on them with the injuries. Later, they're going to do it with real people, with actors. But first, they start off learning in this way. They learn other just proper hygiene, how to protect themselves when they're treating people, and basic first aid skills. Then they learn light search and rescue skills. They learn what's called a size-up process, where they can assess a situation to really look at the probabilities of what's going to happen so that they can determine what can I safely do here, what might likely happen, how to make a plan and then take action and then continually reevaluate that. And they learn some practical skills, how to remove people who have been trapped in a classroom after a disaster, how to do that safely, different lifts, drags, and carries, different search methods. And they learn a CERT organization, the Incident Command System. Probably some of you have heard that. This is the system that all major organizations, fire, police, everybody, hospitals now use, the National Incident Management System. They learn this system. It's a great organizational way to manage emergencies. They also have a unit on disaster psychology, how to reduce their stress as well as survivor stress and to recognize the psychological and physical symptoms of stress. And there's a small unit on terrorism, but mostly a terrorism is a stop sign to them. They're not equipped or involved, allowed to get involved in terrorism. They try to keep people away. And it all culminates with a final major disaster drill where other students who are in the school have various fake injuries. They're placed trapped in the school. The school has a school-wide earthquake drill. When they go to account for everybody after they've evacuated, they find that 25 or 30 students are missing. The CERT team gets activated. They put on their gear. They go in and search. They practice those skills that they've been learning all semester, and they rescue those students, set up a medical treatment area. It's fabulous. They love it. It's like putting all those skills together in one package. And it's a great way to end the system. They use the incident command system. They organize themselves and put it all together. They have a graduation, and we invite dignitaries from the community in, shake their hands, give them a certificate, take photos. And it's just a real sense of accomplishment for them because they have now these lifelong skills where they can really help themselves and help others. We have this as a semester-long class. A school teacher who is already one of the teachers at the school delivers the curriculum, but they have a lot of guest speakers from police and fire and the hospital and Red Cross and retired seismologists and different people in the community that come in and help teach during different parts of the curriculum. And that really introduces students to these different career possibilities, too. A lot of the things that they learn tie into existing curriculum goals and standards. And so how much does it cost? Mostly it's a startup cost, getting those supplies that you need for the protective gear that they wear that are kept at the school that are used reused every year by each new class that's being taught, some of the training aids. And then there's refilling fire extinguishers each year, which is a very minimal cost, and new masks and gloves. The only real cost after the initial startup is just that one instructor for one period a day, making room in the schedule for that person to teach it. So that has been the challenge in one of our high schools to get that done. The others all have it. One of our keys to success is team building. The students do all kinds of team building activities, and they learn how to be a leader, and they learn how to be a follower, and they learn how to work as buddies and as larger teams to accomplish all kinds of different tasks. These skills are so important because we need those in all areas of our life, and they will need those in the future for whatever careers they go into, as well as for their relationships. And we actually, and they learn, okay, today you're going to be a follower. Today you're going to be a leader. How can you be the kind of leader that followers will want to follow? This is so good for them, and they love it, and they grow so much over the course of the semester. It's fabulous to see their personal growth from the beginning to the end of the semester. And then the school ownership is the other key to success. Our schools love Teen Cert because it changes who the students are. It really develops them as responsible citizens in their schools. And so the schools taking ownership and being positive and taking value in it has been one of our keys to success. Students learn all kinds of responsibility, accountability, life-saving skills. One student said, I feel like I can make a difference now. And so it's a real... just a huge self-esteem builder for students, not to mention the personal skills, very important skills that they get. And then the schools have improved school safety and security. They have a whole team of responders in a major disaster, peer role models. But remember, Teen Certs, and we always drill this in, you're not a replacement for professional responders. You're there for only times when professional responders aren't able to get there because of the magnitude of the disaster. And you're there to help stabilize the situation until they can get there. So thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. Going to start with Representative Post, then work our way around.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It might be right up what Representative Lobby said a little while ago. Back to the one, I don't remember how far back it was, the slide that showed the teacher and then the guests. Remember that? There we go.
Yes.
I got to thinking about, and maybe this is more a question for you, Representative Gomberg, but mitigate costs. Let's not put this on the teachers. Let's get those folks. And that's who teaches this. So even in your case, forgive the word eliminate, but I'm just for lack of argument, forget the school teacher position. Perhaps this could all be done by guest speakers who are experts in this field who probably know more about this than the teacher does, unless you specifically hire somebody that's what they do. So I don't know. That's a lot of questions.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Post, I think your point is very well taken. I think that that developing a centralized curriculum will make recommendations on people from various communities that can be brought in to provide a higher level of expertise, a guest speaker, and to reduce costs.
Okay, Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is a great program. So how do students get into the program? Are they chosen? I assume not all high school students get the opportunity? Or
any high school student wants to sign up for it. It's an elective class. Okay. And so, the first year we did it, which I think it's been maybe 8 or 9 years since we've had this, the first year we made an application process where people had to have a certain GPA and a certain behavior record. Mm-hmm. And we did that the first year. And then after that, we're like, anybody can take this class. And now we have a full range of any high schoolers that can take it. And it seems to work for everybody because they do so much teamwork. If there's a little bit of a deficiency somewhere, the team members help pull them along, and so we found that anybody can take it.
That's great.
Yeah, it's much more than 4 hours,
right.
but it's a fabulous thing because it really influences and shapes the student for the rest of their life.
I can see where the students really get into it.
They
That's
love
great.
It. Yeah.
Other questions? Okay, I have a question just to confirm what I think I know, but just to clarify, to Representative Post's point. CERT training isn't necessarily always through schools. In fact, CERT training is in every community, and FEMA has distance learning for all kinds of subjects. Isn't that correct?
Right. Yeah. So CERT was originally an adult training. Right. And so a lot of communities around the nation have CERT. Teen CERT came later. Right. And it can be done in schools. It could be done in 4-H clubs or Boy Scouts and different formats. Yeah. And there are some online courses that can be taken for CERT, too.
So at least a portion of the curriculum to be potentially developed could be borrowed.
Absolutely.
Liberally, perhaps, from that which has already been done.
Right? Certainly.
Okay. Thank you very much for this, and I really, truly appreciate you bringing the bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good bill. We'll need to get a final fiscal on it, and then I hope that you'll adopt the amendments and send it off to Ways and Means and give them a nudge, because I think it'll make a difference down the road.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That exhausts the list of speakers on our little handy-dandy sign-in sheet. Anybody else want to come forward and comment on House Bill 2574 at this time? Okay. Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2574. We're going to go back to the order previously discussed, and we're going to invite up our first one-person panel, Ms. Nancy D'Souza. And I guess she's going to bring a friend.
I don't know. It's Campbell.
Yeah.
We're going to open the informational hearing. And if Ms. D'Souza wants to introduce her friend and herself, that would be good.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nancy D'Souza. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Travel Information Council. We do business also as Oregon Travel Experience. And this is the TIC's lobbyist, Craig Campbell. And he has a very strong emergency preparedness background. And so invited him to come up and speak to you today. And if you'll give us our first slide. When we presented recently to the House Transportation Policy Committee, Chair Evans invited us to come and talk about emergency preparedness in our rest areas. As you likely know, the Oregon Travel Experience operates rest areas on behalf of ODOT. We were given responsibility by the legislature for those, and we now operate of all of these rest areas that you see statewide. These are ODOT's, ones that are also state parks, and then the ones that are highlighted in yellow are the ones that we operate. So if you'll go to the next slide, these are the ones, and Oregon just got long and skinny here today, but you'll see that they're clustered primarily on Interstate 5, Interstate 84. We have two outliers at Tillamook and one at Government Camp, and so we have 29 rest areas at 17 locations around the state. So as you are going through your emergency preparedness planning, what we have to offer is the ability to use our infrastructure. We have a model that puts our staff boots on the ground 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. These are people we hire who live in the local communities, and they're very resourceful. We've seen them get through blizzards and firestorms and all sorts of other things to get to the rest areas to provide support. This past summer, there was, you know, some pretty big wildfires on I-84, and we had staff who were there supporting the firefighters and other people who were trying to get off the freeway and did an excellent job. So what we have at these locations, if you'll just go to the next one, and you'll see this in your materials, we don't need to walk through all of them, is we've provided a list of the rest areas that we manage, the number of acres, whose district they are in, and some of them are large enough that they could be suitable staging areas for some large operations. Some of them, like our Tillamook rest area, which is, you know, way less than an acre, probably not so much, but we have an incredible willingness to participate in the planning and preparation along with ODOT, who, as I said, does own the rest areas, and I know they've been involved in emergency planning. We have resources where, because we are in those rest areas every day of the week, if you wanted secure staging, we could also be providing some oversight of that to make sure that things are safe and secure and report on those. And we're just wanting to present ourselves as absolutely willing partners in keeping Oregon safe.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Craig Campbell. I only have a couple of things to add, and it really deals more with the location of the rest areas. Really three different areas where the rest areas can play a part. Understanding that it's not our book of business, but we're willing partners, so we're working with emergency response-oriented partners to provide what is necessary to use the infrastructure that we have. The first is allowing those locations to be used as forward staging, pre-event supply caches and things along those lines, because they can feed into regional efforts pretty easily. The second thing is in the event of, in a Cascadia-type event, you're going to see some areas of highway collapse, and there will be people who will be trapped on the highways, and it's not unforeseeable that many of them will seek those rest areas for shelter, food, emergency response, and things like that. To the extent that we are prepared with stock assistance and with our folks who are able to mm-hmm. make it to those locations, we can provide that service as well. And then finally, we do need to do more of an assessment to deal with this, but most of our areas are large enough that it could conceivably be used for staging through a heavy lift helicopter, because if you do have the infrastructure collapse, that doesn't mean that these facilities are no longer usable. They could be used by alternative access means, which just adds both as an opportunity for those to be used for medical triage and evacuation centers if necessary.
Great. Thank you.
So we're happy to answer any questions you may have.
And before I get to questions, thank you for putting things together so quickly and being able to present to us. I really do appreciate that. Questions? Yes, sir.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So later we're going to be, the committee here, we'll be talking about the routes, the designated routes and that. So one of the questions I have, and I'm not have the whole history and how you ended up with those versus others, but Highway 97 is a designated route in case of an emergency, but you don't have any routes on there. I assume that there are rest areas, but I'm trying to decide then from a standpoint, given your ability with people and things, where does that fit or doesn't fit, or do you have any potential impact on Highway 97?
Chair Evans and Representative Lively, we do not operate the rest areas on 97. Those are still operated by ODOT. They don't have the same staffing model we do, but they have emergency preparedness plans that they're working on appropriately as well, and I am certain would be happy to discuss those with you.
And if I could be, just to follow up, in previous conversation, part of your long-term plan, though, is perhaps to pick up 97, or could be, if funds were available. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's always a discussion between us and ODOT as to whether or not they want to transfer additional rest areas over to us. And generally, the issue is whether or not there are adequate resources to do that, because our model, because it's staffed, is more expensive. And so if there was a means by which additional revenues could be made available for that, our sense from our discussions is it's very likely that ODOT would be interested in transferring additional rest areas to us, and some of them would start with I-97.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, since you're here, Craig, so the funds, the ODOT funds, what funds are available to that pays for those contracts?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, currently the rest areas that we manage, and again, they're owned by ODOT, but we manage them on their behalf. We're given $6.55 million per year to manage those rest areas. And that was by decision of the legislature, where those funds were committed from the highway fund specifically for this.
The
program.
Highway fund is for
yes.
This.
Yes. And so they, Mr. Chair and Representative Lively, they are still restricted by the same ones constitutionally as the highway funds.
As the highway fund.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My only concern on 97 is there are not that many rest areas on 97. When you start, there's one on the California border. And I think the next one is about, what, Chemult?
Flip back to that first.
And the next one past that, I think, up by Maverick.
Getting Street.
No, we're on 97.
They're not
so we're starting with Midland, and then it's Beaver Marsh that ODOT operates, then it's up to Cal Canyon, or the three that, and Cal Canyon's up above Bend.
There's Collier State Park, but that's a state park.
That's a state park.
Three.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you again for future reference. A little bit later today, we're going to talk about work groups. You will have a standing invitation at the work group on scalable response facilities, and I suspect more than one invitation from Representative Lively on his ground transportation work group to make sure that we have both options available, and in your case, where especially along I-5, post-event, some of them may not be usable, but some may be areas that we can potentially designate and perhaps plus up. So thank you very much for your willingness
thank
to
you.
Participate.
We
appreciate
are pleased
it.
To participate anywhere we can be added value.
Thank you. Okay, we will now go to the second panel, and that is Mr. John Ivey, Disaster Response Director, SEMRS. Please come forward and state your name. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is John Ivey. I'm the Disaster Response Director for SEMRS. I'm not here to talk about Sea Mercy, but I thought that I would just spend a few minutes telling you what I do in international disasters so that when I give you my perspective on our state's level of readiness, you might know where I'm coming from. The goal of our disaster relief program is to stand in the gap from the time of an onset of a disaster and the time it takes the combined government and international emergency machine to get up and running. And so as part of my role, I identify high-risk areas that, I'm sorry, just got my first set of glasses, just hitting 50 years old, so not used to speaking with them. I identify high-risk areas that are very unlikely to have aid delivered to them in a time-sensitive manner. And so we work in the remote islands, mainly of the South Pacific, and this is very logistically difficult to get emergency responders there. There's all kinds of disasters that happen in the South Pacific, so we deal with all kinds of stuff. And so what I do is I identify these areas, and then I go and act as a team leader. I actually go to the disaster areas, and I identify areas where we're going to take emergency shelter, food and water, desalinization units, things like that. Then I also will embed in the National Management Disaster Office of that country, like Fiji or Vanuatu. I'll spend a couple of weeks there, and I work with quarantine, the Ministry of Health, to get our medical professionals cleared through their professional boards, our medicine through biohazard and quarantine, all the government offices. And I also liaise with the Australian and New Zealand military, and I work with the large NGOs like Red Cross, World Food Program, World Health Organization. And then I'm also a search and rescue team leader in Jackson County. So I'm trained under, certified under FEMA, and I've got a whole list of things that we have to take. So I understand that there's some new members on the committee, so Representative Esquivel asked me to spend a few minutes just touching over some facts of what the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake might look like. And so I've condensed about 1,000 pages from our Oregon resiliency plan and our committee into about 6 minutes. So if you'll bear with me, I'll kind of push through these. And the point of me doing this is to shift the focus from a temporary interruption of services to what a disaster really looks like. And I think that most people, even in our and I'm coming from the point of our EMS services here as a trained first responder, most people in the state of Oregon have no idea what they're really talking about when it comes to what a disaster looks like and the chaos and the sheer mass of what's involved. And just a simple 3-day interruption of service is not what we're talking about here. So I'm going to just touch on some of these figures here. In Oregon, under hazards, we live next door to a 700-mile-long fault line. Three pieces of the Earth's crust, specifically the denser Juan de Fuca plate, are being pushed eastward by erupting magma 180 miles off of Oregon's shore. Oregon is sitting to the east on the North American plate, and what's happening is these plates are being pushed under the North American plate, and the North American plate is buckling. The subduction zone is the area of these buried plates, and it's 50 miles wide, and in places it extends just 45 miles off the coast. The mounting forces cause the top plate to swell. Eventually, the fault line will release, and the top plate slides up and over, and these subduction zones produce the world's most powerful earthquakes. Comparison. Many of us will remember the 1994 Northridge, California earthquake. It occurred before dawn in an outlying area about 15 miles northwest of Los Angeles. About 72 people died and 12,000 people were hospitalized. Estimates of damage were $25 billion. This was a 6.7 earthquake on a 10-mile fault zone that lasted for 8 seconds. Geologists estimate in Oregon that we are due for an earthquake between 8.7 and 9.2 that will last between 2 to 4 minutes. According to the USGS, the amount of energy radiated by an earthquake is the measure of the potential damage to man-made structures. For every increase in magnitude by one unit, the associated seismic energy increases by about 32 times. So the difference between the 6.7 and a 9.2 is 80 times. That's 80 times more damage to man-made structures. That's how it's measured. That's an incredible amount of energy. Size of the event. Again, the Cascadia Fault Line is about 700 miles long and runs from Northern California to Canada. Roughly 100% of the time, the lower 350 miles of the fault line slips. The other 50% of the time, the whole fault line slips. Historic occurrence. The last major earthquake we date to 1700. We know this because of tree rings on ghost forests killed by saltwater coming onto land. Core samples of tsunami deposits from Coos Bay salt flats go back to 4,600 years and show the date to 1700. And then we also have evidence from a tsunami that hit the coast of Japan on January 26th in 1700. Using core samples, geologists believe that 19 out of the 41 earthquakes were an 8.7 to 9.2, and the other 22 out of the 41 were 8 to 8.0. Since our last earthquake, we have developed a what's called a slip differential of 60 feet. So the amount of movement that we could expect could be upwards of 60 feet. And this is when I originally wrote up this response plan back in 2013. So it's moved in a little bit more than that. So recently, just in August of 2016, the time schedule has been pushed up. No longer do I think it's our grandchildren's generation. They've now used nearly 200 core samples of underwater landslide deposits left behind from the past subduction zone earthquakes. Chris Goldfinger, a leading expert on tectonic activity and a professor of earth sciences at Oregon State, and his team said that we are, quote unquote, coming due for a shaker. Previous studies were based on as few as 12 samples. Given that data, the chances of a quake hitting central Oregon in the next 50 years has been moved up to 15 to 20%. And I'm going to skip through here a little bit. According to Patrick Cochran, who is a coastal natural hazard specialist, he says that in the next 50 years, there's a 37% chance of a magnitude 8 to 9 striking somewhere on the fault line. So 37% in the next 50 years is pretty high statistics. What damage will the earthquake cause? If the whole fault line goes, the initial death total is estimated at 25,000, but that's the small print. In the meetings with the experts, what they say is if people are at school or at work or commuting, that you could add a zero to that. So over 100,000 people. The types of waves that accompany these earthquakes are long rolling waves, and wood-framed houses should be able to ride them out. Most initial injuries and deaths will be caused by people being struck by falling objects. But what will be hit the hardest is our infrastructure, our power, our food, our water, our hospitals. The real emergency for people will happen in the days and weeks and even months after the emergency. The Western Seismic Policy Council estimates that 399 bridges will suffer total collapse. Another 621 bridges will be heavily damaged and most likely impassable. We only have less than 4,000 bridges. That's about 25% of our bridges here in the state will be impassable. Limiting driving to 3 to 5 miles. 80,000 buildings are subject to being destroyed. Most alarming, over 300,000 students go to school in buildings that are subject to collapse. The estimated initial economic damage is $31 billion, according to our resiliency plan on page 46, earthquake estimated damage in Oregon's economy is in the hundreds of billions of dollars compared to the Japanese tsunami, which was $300 billion in total damages, the earthquake in Kobe, Japan, $200 billion, and Hurricane Katrina, which was $160 billion. So I think that the numbers that are in our literature are very, very conservative. excuse me, roads are estimated to be closed for 3 to 12 months and not fully restored to 3 to 5 years. All access routes like the 5 freeway will be down. A tsunami will strike the coast 8 to 15 minutes after the quake and will destroy portions of Highway 101 and many portions of coastal cities. East-west corridors to the coast will be largely destroyed and take 3 to 5 years to be rebuilt. All assistance efforts will be staged on the 97 on the eastern side of the Cascades. Water. During the North Ridge earthquake, much of the region's aging water system broke down, cutting water pressure to homes and making it very difficult to fight fires. It wasn't only a fighting fire concern. 10,000 homes were left without water for 5 days. Many of our city's water and waste processing systems will be subject to failure. Wells will shift, and wells also require power. On page 230 of the Oregon Resiliency Plan, it says that if the earthquake would happen today, it would mean catastrophic results in Oregon's water and water waste systems. According to the Western Seismic Policy Council, we face a greater problem in that our systems are dependent on each other. We cannot fix the power and fuel lines until we have usable roads. We can't fix the roads until bridges are fixed and debris cleaned, and we can't fix the bridges until we have liquid fuel. Unfortunately, all of our liquid fuel runs from Portland and crosses 15 rivers, including the 1930s bridges, and they all run through pipes that were built in 1960 before there were seismic standards built into building codes. On our resiliency plan on page 191, more than 90% of Oregon's refined fuel comes from Puget Sound from the area of Washington State. Some of those buildings in the CEI hub where all the fuel passes through are 100 years old, and many of the buildings are built to no or very antiquated standards. So we've got some serious issues with our fuel. According to the Food Marketing Institute, consumers go to the grocery store 1.6 times a week, and that households have less than 1 week of food on hand. In addition, grocery stores stock less than 3 days' worth of food for the residents they cater to. In Jackson County, for example, over 95% of Jackson County's food is trucked in. That, coupled with the fact that grocery stores don't stock enough food for the 206,000 residents, means that we will have widespread food shortages. What to expect on the coast? When the upper plate lifts, it will raise an elongated pile of water 30 to 50 feet above the surface. Simultaneously, the coast will drop by 6 feet, 3 to 6 feet. The water pileup and energy will divide itself. Half will go out into the ocean, and half will head towards shore. The waves will compress as they reach shallow water and rise in height. The tsunami waves resulting from Japan's 9.1 earthquake, where a 50-mile strip, 180 miles long, was lifted 50 feet in the air. Within a half an hour, the waves arrived on Japan's coast, and they topped out at 134 feet, surged 6 miles up the coast, killing 22,000 people for the result of the devastation. The waves resulting from a subduction zone earthquake off the coast of Oregon will arrive in 8 to 25 minutes. Computer models vary, but the old predictions of 30 feet has been greatly increased to figures of 100 or even 130 feet by the computer models run by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Seattle. River mouths, drainages, floodplains, beaches, and similar low terrain features will be inundated with water. So what do we do? When I was a board member of the Jackson County Search and Rescue, I was at a meeting, and I said, all right, so what's our plan? You know, what are we going to do? What's our communication plan? We've got 100 members. How do we get these members out? And there was no answer. So I said, well, what's the role as we're trained first responders, what are we going to do? And there was absolutely no answer. And so I wrote a response plan for first responders. And so that's what I'm going to talk to you about today. This disaster will be so widespread that there will not be immediate EMS or assistance available. So one of the state organized meetings that I went to that had trained state and county trained first responders, law enforcement, hospital workers, search and rescue guys like myself, It was stated that it was understood that most, if not all, EMS will see to the needs of their immediate families and would not be responding for the first several days to a week after an event, and that those that, who could stay on duty certainly couldn't work 24/7. And due to the roads being down, most would not likely be able to get into the command centers or their departments, or even if they were there, get out to help the people. People will have to be able to fend for themselves for an extended period of time. Natural disasters happen all the time, especially in the part of the world that I work in. It's a common occurrence. Sorry. Just because a disaster has not happened here in our living memory doesn't negate the fact that it's happened 41 times over the last 10,000 years and will happen again relatively soon. Remember the estimate of a 37% chance of a greater than 8.0 earthquake within the next 50 years and a 15 to 20% chance of an 8 to 9.2 over the next 50 years. We buy all types of insurance and make contingency plans for events that percentage-wise have a much less chance of happening. The term normalcy bias refers to the mental state of people enter when facing a disaster. It causes people to underestimate both the possibility of a disaster occurring and its possible effects. This may result in situations where people fail to adequately prepare for a disaster, and on a larger scale, the failure of the government to provide the populace or to include the populace in its disaster planning. Perhaps a better way to look at it is to bring it closer to home. How much food do you have on hand, right? How much do you have? How much stored drinking water, fuel, cash, extra prescription medications, enough for a month? What if your family and your neighbors show up and it's just, we just had 14 inches of snow and you have no power and water? Do you have the means to cook your own food without electricity, keep cool or warm? What about firefighting, security, communication, hygiene, dealing with sickness, dead bodies, waste disposal, medical treatment, basic shelter rebuilding? By asking you to think about your own level of personal preparedness in an emergency, my hope is that you who are in the know will see that you perhaps have some work to do, how much more the uninformed Oregon citizen. All right, so let's get to our residential preparedness plan.
Mr. Ivey, you could wrap it up.
Yes, sir.
Just about 4 or 5 minutes, if you could wrap it up.
Yes.
Okay. It's great information.
Okay, so
people in the back, their eyes are about this big now.
Okay.
You've got their attention.
Got it. Okay. So basically, the plan is, all right, so I will go to our recap. To recap, we have to have our EMS responders in the field. And based on the best scientific knowledge, that field will be their own neighborhoods. They're not going to be able to get out to Station 1 or Station 7 to be able to respond. It's not going to happen. I'm going to be at my home taken care of. So I'm going to have to create an ad hoc team. And so the idea, give me just a couple minutes here to run through it because it's a good plan. We have Jackson County has 100 volunteers. Each member would be responsible for the emergency education and preparation for 10 people. This is their base. This includes the responders' immediate family members and neighbors on each side. The final two members are people that that would be carefully pre-selected emergent volunteers that live near the state-trained first responder who are willing to assist in the event of an emergency. The emergency preparation will consist of a series of videos that take a family of four in a year and teach them basics in an hour-long video, 14 videos, how to prepare for a year on a budget of $20 a month for $240. It covers all of the things that I mentioned before, how to take care of your family. So the idea is that I'm a first responder. I'm not going to be able to get there. I have two, Tom, Pete and Terry. One's a nurse. One's a kind of a handyman. These are the guys who I would want if I've got to go pull people out of buildings. But I know that Pete and Terry also have families of their own. They're not going to be able to help me if they have to go and attend to their family's needs. So the idea is that I get my family, my immediate neighbors, and my two ad hoc team members squared away by introducing them to this online training program that the state creates. I've actually already made video topics for you guys. And then that's a base, right? That then those two guys also have to take care of their families and their immediate neighbors. So at this first level, it's 30 people, right, per first responder. Pete and Terry, people on their street, they're going to go, wow, this guy and this guy, they're unprepared. They're actually going to reproduce the team at a second level and then fill in the gaps at a third level. By the time it's reached the third level per responder, it's 150 people that are taken care of. So just for the members of Jackson County, which is 100 search and rescue emergency first responders, that equates to about 15,000 people, which is 7.6% of Jackson County's population. That's just search and rescue guys. That's not your firefighters. That's not all your EMS, your doctors and nurses. We have to make sure that our emergency service people are able to respond. The place that they're going to be able to respond is going to be in their neighborhoods. We need to make that efficient for them and train them that, hey, you might be called to response and called to put your training into use in civic duty in your neighborhoods. And so you're going to have to look around and go, all right, who are going to be my emergent volunteers? It's going to be this guy and this guy. Well, what do I have to do to make sure that those guys are going to be prepared to work with me in this project? They've got to have their own family squared away and their immediate neighbors. Mm-hmm. And so if I think that we are greatly underestimating what a disaster looks like. This is not a temporary interruption of services. They call it a disaster because it is chaos. And dealing with this is going to be an international response. And if you don't think the UN and all of the international aids are going to come here and take over your local offices, you haven't been to see what a disaster looks like. Usually the military comes in and internationally it's called a cluster organization, and they come in and it's like a bad movie where they move somebody aside and they take over the offices and they don't leave.
We want to avoid the term cluster.
Yeah, exactly, but that's what it's called. You've got to be kidding me on my first one. So the idea is that we need to retrain the thought process for our emergency responders to get them out in the field and get them used to the idea of working in their own neighborhoods. Right. And I've sent you the digital copy of this, and as well at the end of this you can see the 14-part video that I've laid out that has a bunch of suggestions for the video topics. I don't have any agenda with this. There was no plan, and it was on my heart to write up a plan, and I'm happy to help in any way that I can.
And Mr. Ivey, before I open up for questions, I want to invite you to work with Mr. Steve Robinson and other volunteers, along with our work groups that we have here, to make sure and take your ideas into specific areas of focus so that your ideas are not lost. It's not just one talk and done. We want to include you in the process. Okay?
Thank you, Mr.
So,
Chairman.
Questions?
Yeah.
Mr. Post?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman and Mr. Ivey, this is really good, and I really appreciate you doing this. I held a town hall meeting in Newburgh, I guess it was 2 years ago, with Senator Thatcher, and we had, I was trying while you were talking to try to remember who it was who came, but it was a couple of experts from the state and one from the feds, and talking about Cascadia subduction. It was interesting. I just, for your information, for the information of the committee, when it got done, we opened it up to questions and answers from the public. They were, as our chair has mentioned a moment ago, their eyes were that big, everybody in Newburgh. And one gentleman in the back was quite insistent. He kept asking somebody, what are my chances if I live west of I-5 of living through this? And he wouldn't answer, and he wouldn't answer, and he wouldn't answer. And finally, this old gentleman would not give up, and it was 50-50. So does that sound...
Okay.
And if so, the thing that I'm not meaning to make light, but I'm like, if my chances are 50-50,
so I'm going to survive, and my kids are going to survive. The whole Griffin Creek area where I live, I've gone around and talked to all my neighbors. I've put away enough food for a year for my family and my neighbors. I've got tertiary systems of communication, of solar power, of triage kits, medicine, security for our whole valley. So how do you love your neighbor? I got 206,000 neighbors in Jackson County, and that's where I pushed it to. It's very survivable. Most of the injuries when I deal with disasters are not from the actual disaster itself. It's from dysentery and sepsis and getting cut on debris or getting hurt or malnutrition, things that happen afterwards. This is going to be a huge mess, and it's way beyond the scope. I mean, I love COPE and I love CERT and even the two weeks ready now. These programs are fantastic, but they're not based on a reoccurring long-term disaster that we're looking at here. I mean, we're talking 3 to 5 years. Some of these transformers to get our power grid up, there's only 26,000 of them that are made. You have to open up roads to drive them down. They're just, we don't have them. This disaster will forever change. This will be the worst disaster in the history of the United States, and it will forever change the face of Oregon and our country, and people look at it like this is a temporary interruption of service. Disasters are not like that. If it was not chaos, it would be called something different. So, thank you very much.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this is great, and I like the way it's presented. I think we've heard a lot of conversations about what it might be, and it pretty puts it in pretty stark terms, which is good. But recently I've heard conversations about, we go back to the percentage in that there's a higher percentage that the event that will occur next is going to be an event more on the southern Oregon coast and not the whole zipper. So I'm trying to understand from your perspective when you're talking about preparedness and that. So is the reason that we would want to focus more based on percentages, even though I understand the 37, but some of the information now they're developing saying because of the way that the coast is and the chances are more likely in the near term, the 50 years and that. That the event that's going to occur isn't going to occur all the way north, but it's going to occur so southern Oregon is most impacted about it. So it goes back to the odds maybe, but it goes back to when we're getting this out, how we're going to get people prepared for it. Does it make some sense that that information, that we use that information, say, in southern Oregon to raise the awareness to do it versus trying to the whole coast and alert the whole state at this point to that? I'm just trying to understand.
Because gotcha.
There's a difference of opinion.
I agree. Thank you, Representative Lively and Chairman. Statistics can be skewed and bent for whatever you want. Some of the intervals are 240 years, some are 1,000 years, and you're looking at averages here.
Right.
Every time, about 100% of the time that there's an earthquake here, the lower 350 mile gets it. They get it no matter what. It seems that a 9.2 would be farther out, but a 15-20% chance, I mean, that's still on my money. I'm going for the big one. Okay. You know, I'm preparing for if it's but still an 8.0 is a big stinking earthquake. You're talking these tilt up buildings that are built before 1970. They're all going down, right? So I would not undercut that at all. I would make it a statewide preparation because this might be a generational thing. My kids are here with me today and know exactly what I'm speaking at because it will affect them as well.
Sure.
They weren't listening, were they?
Question?
That's right. They're Boy Scouts.
Right.
They're prepared.
Well, first of all, again, thank you very much. Sometimes somebody with passion can burn through people's mindsets when agency reports and data and other things can't. So again, thank you, and we will make sure that staff and you are in coordination, as we are with other folks. I just want to remind
Steve.
I just want to remind folks, as far as the work groups that we're hopefully going to be starting or have already started. One of the things that I want to start reminding folks is that if you have ideas or suggestions, to contact a legislator that has the lead on these work groups. So again, Representative Post is heading up the ARES amateur radio communications piece. Representative Lively is going to be leading up the ground transportation piece and routes. Representative Meek is going to be leading up and has already met once, I know, on airports. I'm looking at both the state airports as well as areas that could be used as potential airports when the military and others come in. Representative Parrish, you might be interested in her particular work group. She is trying to ferret out how Citizen Corps is functioning versus maybe how it's supposed to, credentialing, and then document security and protection. Representative Escoval, who I believe is the person who suggested you to come today, and I'm grateful for that, he is heading up the DPSST FEMA OEM overlay in terms of what types of training are currently available and how it's being delivered. And then my work group is focused on facilities and response and recovery facilities. All of these work groups, Mr. Volk is the coordinator for, so that we're all working together in tandem. But we have volunteers like Mr. Robinson and lobbyists and citizens on any one of these providing input. So my question is, comment, based on what you said, I'm going to assume that you want to be involved in some of these. We would certainly benefit from your experience, especially on putting that perspective of large catastrophic events outside the United States, that 50,000-foot look about how things plug in and how, if they're not ready for assistance, how delays can actually create an event. So thank you very much for coming forward and sharing today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
All right. We're going to close the informational session for today, and I'm going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Esquivel for a couple of public hearings. We're going to concurrently open two public hearings on 2886 and 2888, and I'm going to hand the gavel over and get out of the way.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2886.
Thank you, Vice Chair Esquivel. House Bill 2886. It requires the Office of Emergency Management to develop and implement a strategy to select and outfit suitable public places for emergency response and recovery purposes in coordination with other state and local entities. It creates the Oregon Public Places Are Safe Places Investment Fund to receive unspecified appropriations for continuous distribution to the Office of Emergency Management. The state declares an emergency when federal and state resources are needed to supplement local resources in the face of an imminent threat or its aftermath. An emergency declaration puts a state's emergency operations plan into effect in order to coordinate and direct response and recovery. In Oregon, as in most states, the governor has authority under a declaration of emergency to expend necessary funds and assume control over policy and all executive branch agencies in affected areas. House Bill 2886 requires the Office of Emergency Management to develop a process to select and outfit public places for use in emergencies and establishes a corresponding accounting structure to receive funds. The measure provides OEM with broad discretion to develop and implement a strategy in coordination with other appropriate state and local entities and authorizes rulemaking to that end. Insofar as we have received a fiscal impact and a revenue impact statements, there's minimal revenue impact. However, for fiscal purposes, it's a one-page document. I'll just read part of it. If funds were available and limitation authority provided, the department estimates that the need for two full-time positions to implement the program and an accountant position to provide financial assistance and a program analyst to position to implement the program. Total cost of the positions for full biennium is estimated to be approximately $339,400.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Vice Chair Esquivel, members of the committee. I'll try to keep my comments very brief. And House Bill 2886 and 2888 are linked in my mind. Just a few points. Many of you may recognize 2886 because your names are on it. It was a committee bill last session that I brought forward again for consideration this session, really to achieve three things. The first is to establish the fund. If the bill moves, and again, we will obviously have conversation about if the bill moves, but the creation of a fund to do certain and specific targeted investments is really the most valuable piece of this particular bill. The reason I say that is there is a companion bill that will be introduced in the next few days that would create a task force to be able to do much of the work that this directs OEM to do. Theoretically, the task force would actually provide recommendations that should limit the fiscal impact for the agency and give a multifaceted direction. But taken as a group, the two concepts are focused on trying to come up with a rational, multidisciplinary strategy to look at assets that we have and to ensure that investment is smart for both catastrophic events, for more common emergency events like wildfires, et cetera, as well as potentially even good for business if we do it correctly. So this one is 2886, again, is one approach. Another bill will be up relatively soon that is a slightly different approach, trying to get to the same goal. House Bill 2888 is really designed to do three things. Number one, was accomplished.
I didn't open a public hearing on 2888.
Then I will wait for 2888, Vice Chair Escobar.
What's that fancy timer?
Are there any questions about 2886?
On 2886.
Sir.
Any questions? I'm dying to hear the second part of this. Okay. We have someone that would like to testify. Andrew Phelps? Join Representative Evans?
This is 86. But if you talk with
this is 86.
They are linked.
Now, Representative Evans, I have a complaint.
Sir.
When you testify, the hourglass goes away.
I see that.
Yeah, when the rest of us testify, it's there.
I don't know where it went, actually. I think Bradley hit it.
Sorry.
Vice Chair Esquivel, members of the committee. I'm Andrew Phelps, Director of the Oregon Office of Emergency Management within the Department of Military Affairs, the Oregon Military Department, and I'm here to provide testimony on House Bill 2886. Should this legislation become law, OEM would leverage the experiences of partner agencies and organizations throughout Oregon and across the country to identify best practices for establishing dual-use staging areas, especially during catastrophic disasters like a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, which some of you may have heard about, maybe recently as today, which are no-notice incidents that immediately create an austere infrastructure environment with severely degraded or non-existent communication and transportation capabilities. OEM would also seek to understand whether or not the public spaces identified through this act would be intended to stage emergency response equipment and personnel while awaiting a deployment assignment, or could be used as a community point of distribution or dispensing. The Oregon Military Department takes a neutral position on this bill, and that concludes my prepared remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2886. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2888. You're on again, sir.
Vice Chair Escobar, members of the committee, thank you very much for...
Oh, yes, to read it first.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Vice Chair Escobar. House Bill 2888 establishes grant program to assist publicly owned utilities with eligible emergency response, recovery, and mitigation projects to be administered by the Office of Emergency Management. It creates the Oregon Public Utility Homeland Security Commission within OEM to review grant applications. It establishes the Oregon Public Utility Homeland Security Fund to receive unspecified monies for program operation. It authorizes the state treasurer to issue lottery bonds at the request of the Department of Administrative Services after consultation with OEM. House Bill 2888 establishes a grant program to provide financial assistance for emergency preparedness and response projects undertaken by publicly owned utilities. The measure establishes the Oregon Public Utility Homeland Security Commission within OEM to review grant applications, and OEM administers the program and awards grants based on those recommendations. The measure also creates the necessary accounting structures and authorizes the issue of lottery bonds. So far as I can tell, did we receive a revenue statement yet? There is a fiscal statement. Part of the analysis is that OEM is directed to use the monies in the fund to provide grants to consumer-owned utilities for certain projects. The fund shall include monies from issuance of lottery bonds. The measure includes a blank for the proposed amount of lottery bonds to be issued, and until an amount of lottery bonds is determined, the fiscal impact of the measure is indeterminate.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Escobar, members of the committee. This bill is a follow-up to conversations and a bill we had last session. It is an attempt to try and really accomplish three things. Number one, for public utilities that by nature of their construct do not have to worry about profitability, it would bring public utilities into the planning nexus to ensure that as we look at plussing up resiliency and perhaps key facilities for response and recovery, that public entities, public agencies that provide power may be interested or located in such a way that we could actually generate 24/7 power from these facilities using their available resources and interest. Please understand, I am not opposed to having independently or investor-owned utilities as a part of this, but rather because public is, in fact, by definition, not about profitability, it seemed like they would be a first place to start in terms of strategic planning for investments. The goal is to, quite frankly, bring the utilities into the discussion to ensure not just response, but in some cases, smart development of mitigation strategies. I want to use as an example a project that was completed in Ohio. Later in this session, we're going to bring in the companies from Oregon that actually built this particular facility, but it was a state, in the state of Ohio, there was a priority to protect a particular transformer complex, and it was designed to ensure protection against both terror events as well as natural disasters. It was large scale. It's the kind of thing that nobody is going to probably say to investors, boy, we need to do that right now. But yet, that public investment and that sense of certainty does have a particular value. So the idea is really to, number one, bring utilities in. Number two, create a fund that's specific so that folks that are geared for this type of work and have an interest can play a role in doing that, not for profitability, but certainly to make sure and offset some of the costs, because ultimately one of the things we learn from major catastrophes is it is, as was said earlier, if you don't know how to get the energy grid back up and you are reliant upon a structure that doesn't have a lot of options or micro power generations as potentials, you end up with a lot longer problem. The idea is to provide us options for scalable response. The idea is to find facilities where perhaps renewable power could be 24/7 generating so that in a time of disaster, all people need to do is roll up and be able to use it. And then also during times of non-disaster, to be able to have that excess power go into the grid to be able to offset the need for building perhaps energy construction overall, this bill right now is a beginning of the conversation. It's certainly not a finished product, but I wanted to get it up at the beginning of the session so that we could begin the dialogue necessary to ensure that the appropriate partners are involved in the process.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Andrew Phelps.
Chair Evans, Vice Chair Esquivel, members of the committee. I am Andrew Phelps, Director of the Oregon Military Department's Office of Emergency Management, and I'm here today to provide testimony on House Bill 2888. For decades, OEM has administered state and federal grant programs aimed at mitigating the impacts of all hazards on infrastructure, including consumer-owned utilities. Case in point, the historic rain in the Portland area, surpassing even the previous records set in February 1996, for those of you that remember that catastrophic month from a rain and precipitation perspective, is evident of some of the benefits of successful mitigation programs. We haven't seen nearly the impact of these historic rains as we had seen in 1996 and in 2007, and that's a direct result of effective mitigation practices. Similarly, OEM manages public assistance grants following presidential disaster declarations to repair damaged infrastructure, including infrastructure and damages to eligible consumer-owned utilities. Another illustrative fact of this successful program Our most recent disaster declaration, disaster 4296, which declared a federal disaster declaration in Josephine and Lane counties, is documented to have accrued just over $16 million in eligible disaster costs. Of those, $12 million in damages were to consumer-owned utilities. So these are program areas in which we operate, both from the mitigation standpoint and the recovery standpoint. The Oregon Military Department takes a neutral position on this bill, and that concludes my prepared remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. Next, I'm going to call up, well, I'm not sure where Ted Case and Danielle Romain, are you for, against, or okay, both of you, because I don't want to get the Hatfields and the McCoys up here. State your name for the record.
Chair Evans, Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. We have 18 electric co-ops in the state, representing about 500,000 Oregonians in some of the most rural and remote parts of the state. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2888. As the chair mentioned, we did have this conversation in the 2015 session and look forward to continuing these discussions. I can say that on the very best day, keeping the power on in rural Oregon is very, very difficult. The members that I serve the very sparse areas. We seem to attract every biblical type event that you can have, whether it's flood or what have you. We do serve the South Coast, and we heard from Mr. Ivey in very stark terms, I thought, and probably very accurate terms, what was going to happen there. So I will not recount that. But I will say that we are taking steps to try to mitigate against that. Coos Curry Electric Cooperative serves the Gold Beach area, Port Orford. They're doing things, changing out their wood transmission towers to steel. They're looking at setting their substations to put them on to something that's called flex, where they will sort of not shake to death with respect to a Cascadia-type event. We're stockpiling food for our employees, doing all sorts of things. But I think the point, and to the chair's point, all these take resources, take money. We are not for profit. These are very small utilities, and we're trying to figure out ways to finance that. And so we really look forward to being partners with this committee, with whatever work group, whatever path forward, to working with you to find ways to make sure that we can survive the unthinkable and find innovative ways to deal with these very difficult situations. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Chair Evans, members of the committee, for the record, Danielle Romain representing the Oregon People's Utility District Association, also consumer-owned utilities. We have six electric utilities in the state. We have two on the coast, really representing from about Cannon Beach down to Coos Bay, so a big part of the Oregon coast. Thank you, Chair Evans, for bringing this issue to the committee. We support your work and want to work with you on this important issue. Specifically, all of our PUDs have developed an all-hazards plan that can be used for varying levels of emergencies, including a Cascadia subduction earthquake and tsunami event. We're coordinating with all the local, county, tribal, state, and federal government agencies and other utilities on disaster preparedness. Central Lincoln PUD is located within the designated tsunami zone, and they have already relocated staff from three offices in Waldport, Depot Bay, and Toledo, which are located in the tsunami zone. They've conducted a seismic evaluation on their headquarters building in Newport. They've started construction of a new operations facility to replace the South Beach facility, which is in the tsunami zone and over 60 years old. They've started to remodel current operations in Florence to include seismic upgrades throughout, and they've also completed a vulnerability risk assessment of all their transmission, fiber, and substations. They've trained all their employees in the National Incident Command System, and they've developed an all-hazards emergency action plan. They've added regional mutual aid agreements and equipped all of their vehicles with a three-day supply of food and water. So efforts are ongoing, but obviously more needs to be done, and we look forward to coordinating with you on those efforts. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. So I had a question. You were talking about the work that's ongoing. So if nothing changes, everything's the way it is, how long is it going to take to harden the system down there in that area, the Southern Oregon coast, and that to where whatever standard you're trying to get it to, you reach that standard?
It is an ongoing process. Chair Evans, Representative Lively, thank you for the question. It's an ongoing process. It's going to take years and years. We obviously are very integrated with the Bonneville Power Administration. They have a lot of the high-voltage transmission lines, so we do a lot of work with them. They're doing a lot of work on this. But this is something that is we're budgeting for it, knowing that it could never occur, but it's something that we take very seriously. And the co-op down there knows, particularly along, they're right along 101 there, that it's very unlikely, if Mr. Ivey's prediction is true and those, that they're going to survive this. I mean, this is going to be cataclysmic to that area. But they're preparing for the day and making the best effort to survive it. But it's a multi-year process.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Is that right on the highway 101 at Gold Beach?
Correct.
Co-op?
Yes.
Yeah. So any questions?
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2888. Turn this back over to the chair.
All right. Thank you. Before we conclude today, we have accomplished all of our business for the day. Thank you to everybody that was here, especially some of the IOU folks who are perhaps a little more interested now than perhaps were. Thank you very much to the public co-ops that are interested and all that sat through the wake-up session from Mr. Ivey. Mm-hmm. I think everybody's a little more awake now than perhaps they were before, which is a good thing. Just two quick reminders to everybody. If we could begin work on the work groups. I know some have started, some are in the process of going through the list of who you'd like to have. To the extent that Mr. Volk's time and the volunteer cadre of folks that have signed up to help can be of help, please let us know what you need to be successful. The other thing is, I'm going to ask Mr. Volk to tell us what's on the agenda for Thursday so we have a look on what's going on next.
Thank you, Chair Evans. We hope to have one informational speaker. His name is Eric Ensley from the Veterans Service Program in Multnomah County. We have four bills scheduled, House Bill 2233, House Bill 2234, and House Bill 2235. I believe that the sponsor is Representative Parrish on all three. And House Bill 2149, it will also be heard if things go as planned.
All right. Any questions or comments for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair, I would like to add one thing. I've been in a 6.5 earthquake, and you couldn't stand up. You almost, it was kind of like if you can imagine, have you ever tried to walk on maybe a waterbed or maybe jello? That's what it was like. And you almost fell down, but you didn't quite fall down. And that was just a 6.5.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. Thank you all. Have a good rest of the day. We are closed. Rest of the day. We are closed.